Members, I call the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. A quorum is present. We are going to move the minutes. We have two sets, so hopefully members have had a chance to look. And I'm going to ask Co-Vice Chair Burkle if you would move the minutes from March 17th, as long as there's no issues, members.
I would move the minutes from March 17th, Chair Heintzman.
All right, members, the minutes from March 17th are before us. All those in favor of moving those minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are passed from March 17th. We'll now move on to March 12th. In your packet, members, any issues with the minutes from March 12th? Co-Vice Chair
Burkle. Mr. Chair, I've reviewed the minutes from March 12th and I've moved their adoption.
All right. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We have the minutes approved from March 12th. So, members, we have an extremely full agenda today, and we're going to try to make our way through as best we can. First up, today, we're going to have Representative Bliss. There's a few very district-specific member bills up today, some agency bills, and a few that are a priority for job creators around our state. Since we do have an agenda as tight as we do today, testifiers, just telling you ahead of time, I think that you would have otherwise noticed in our announcement for the committee that you'd be limited to 2 minutes. So just do be aware of that. Mr. Yang will have a timer running. I'm not going to interrupt you and tell you 30 seconds or what have you. You'll hear the alarm go off, and we'll ask you to please at that time stop your testimony. So just putting that out there for everyone before we get started. Representative Bliss, since you are not a member of the committee, I will move that House File 4253 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. And then we want to go with the author's amendment right away.
Yes, okay. Mr. Chair, thank you.
All right, then I will also move the author's DE amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like for today's discussion. Any questions on the amendment, members? Otherwise, I'll move forward. All right. All those in favor of the author's amendment, the DE1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? All right. Representative Bliss, the bill is in the shape that you would like, and before the committee, please proceed with your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill was brought, I wrote it, but there was an issue in my district where the DNR was requiring removal of several boat structures. I passed the bill, the photos of the boat structures along. As you can see, they're not really much different than a boat lift, probably even a little bit better. The reason for the DE is I had to get something in before deadline. I've been working with the DNR, and they have come up with the language. And it's not just my district. This is happening in other districts as well. This simply grandfathers those existing ones in. To replace them is several thousand dollars. And this is a retirement community. They're all privately owned. And the DNR is here to ask any questions. Again, the language did come from the DNR, so there shouldn't be any issues with them, hopefully.
All right. Assistant Director, would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jason Meckel, Assistant Division Director, Ecological and Water Resources at the DNR. I'm fighting a cold, and I've got a pocket full of cough drops, and we got a full agenda today, so I'll do my best. Thank you for that. Mr. Chair, as Representative Bliss has said, we've been working with them on this bill language, and what we think is that this is a reasonable solution. We recognize that there's a broader issue here with boat storage structures. There's different situations around the state that we experience, and not all of these boat storage structures have adhered to the fabric canopy requirement. And so we've got a number of these existing structures. The language that we've worked with the representative on provides a grandfathering, if you will, but it doesn't allow these to continue to be installed going forward. And then, you know, we're happy to continue to work with the author and others if there's concerns that we need to address.
All All right. Before we move to member questions, I'll just quickly ask if there's anyone that wanted to testify on this that hadn't signed up or gone through any process. Not seeing any hands or anybody running to the desk, so Representative Bliss, we're going to have some members' questions. If anybody has any, Representative, excuse me, Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. First of all, I'm trying to get an idea of how widespread is it right now that we have these structures all over. I know it was originally looked at one lake, but I'm hearing from you it's all over. So what is the situation as they start getting old and aging out? What happens in those type of situations? And how far across the state are we looking at that we have these current structures that are not meeting current statute?
Assistant Director.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Fisher, thank you for that question. We don't really know how widespread they are, but we do know that there are more of these around Leech Lake, in particular because of the situation around the Leech Lake and some of these inland harbors that are constructed because of the shoreline and the wind fetch and issues that they deal with. We also are aware in northern Minnesota that they're more common because of bedrock issues and things like that, but we don't have a real handle on it. That's why we've said we think this is a broader issue that needs a little bit further study. We don't know how widespread they are. I mean, I can tell you from the lakes that I've recreated on, they're not common, but I only recreate on a few lakes.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. In terms of, you know, we aren't too sure where they are, how does the word get out there? So in other words, if you've got contractors out there installing these things, how do we know, and what is the enforcement mechanism? What are the penalties if somebody puts up a structure that's not permissible? How does that get addressed with, or are we going to have this people coming back for exceptions in the future? How are we going to address this problem ongoing?
Assistant Director.
Mr. Chair and members, good question. I think we're going to have to rely on the enforcement that we have the ability to enforce, and we can use air photos to know what's been in place prior to so that there's no new construction. This is a challenge. Manufacturers are constantly coming out with new products, new offerings, but we'll have to work with the industry to make sure that folks are aware of what's allowed and what's not allowed under the new provisions and restrictions.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you. So what I'm understanding right now is the current facilities that you're working, that we're addressing here have already been already constructed, are already existing, even though we had a statute in place saying you shouldn't be doing this. So are we really getting to the right part of the problem here? Is there something else that we need to be addressing so that we aren't back here another year or two with somebody's, well, you know, I didn't know that, you know, this manufacturer came in, put in all these other things. Yeah, I'm just trying to look at how we're going to, you know, prevent this from coming up, because while we have the statute that was currently in place, you know, now we've got it, you know, we've got the problem before us now. So what is the penalty? So in other words, is if we have illegal structures going up in the future, does that mean they'll have to take them down?
Assistant Director.
Mr. Chair and members, I think with the provisions that this says that it's prior to now, right, basically, then they would have to take them down if they were new construction.
All right, I'm not seeing any others on my list. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, could you describe for the committee what the concern is with regards to non-canvas roofs?
Assistant Director.
Mr. Chair and members, a canvas roof, typically a fabric cover, typically comes off every year and then goes back on. And that allows them to last longer because they're not exposed to the elements year-round. So historically, the concern is that you've got this quasi-permanent roof structure that's out over a public water, and it's shading the lake bed year-round instead of just during the open water season, the summer season when boats are in there. There's also concern that wind storms can impact these structures and lift these materials and lift them out into the lake, and now we've got debris and that sort of thing getting into the lake. And I think historically the thought was that fabric was less risky than something like metal sheet pile, or not sheet pile, but metal structures and shingles and things that are going to blow all over the lake. That's why I said I think we recognize there's a broader issue here for the state of Minnesota to wrestle with, but in this particular situation. We've got some of these existing structures, and we're trying to find a workable solution.
So it looks like we are at the end of member questions. I've personally worked on these structures and had to try to repair and replace in cases where the fabric has worn, sun has, because many of them are permanent. And there's examples all over my district. But at the same time, yep, there are plenty, the majority of those that come down. There's probably a discussion to have as to whether or not metal would be more difficult to address as a contaminant of sorts compared to a fabric, plastic coated in most cases, I'm assuming. So I think there's maybe a larger discussion. So Chair Fisher, I don't think we're going to solve all those problems today, so it will be an ongoing conversation going forward, more than likely beyond this session and this year. And I hope that we can talk more about some potential options for folks that are trying to work on this problem. Representative Bliss, if you want to close, that would be just
sure. I appreciate the time. One of the questions I asked the DNR when we first started doing this is, if there's a reason, let me know. I'd be happy to go talk to my constituents and tell them a reason why they're going to have to spend upwards of $20,000 to replace these things. The shades the lake bottom, but this isn't a private harbor. I was told that's not a concern there. There's no contaminant difference between the dye on a canvas thing and the steel. There's plenty of sunlight to get down under the docks, as you've seen in the picture that I sent around. So it just makes sense to allow this to go through, and I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bliss. So, members, I will renew my motion that House File 4253, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over.
Thank you.
Next up, Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz, your motion is to move that House File 4019 be recommended to be referred to the General Register. Is that right?
That is my motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I see that you have an author's amendment. Would you like to work on that now or later?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would first like to move to adopt the DE4 amendment.
All right. Representative Schultz moves the DE4 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like for today's discussion. Members, any concerns or issues with that? Seeing none, all those in favor of moving the DE4, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? All right, Representative Schultz, the bill is before you in the shape that you wanted. Would you like to do the A1 in case I may have missed the order?
I would, Mr. Chair. I have a desire, thank you, Mr. Chair, to move the A1 amendment, which is to the DE4 amendment. And I would move that now.
All right, members, any discussion we need to have on the A1 to the D4?
Thank you.
Chair Fisher, thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that this amendment came in late, and I'm grateful for Chair Fisher and DFL members of the committee for your willingness to work with me on this. I have one further clarification that I'd like to do orally for the committee. So if we're working from the A1 amendment, my specific desire is to go to line 1.6, and then after the word after, strike installation of a new well, and insert the words, a water permit has been issued.
Members, any discussion to the verbal amendment? Janelle, if you want to clarify for the committee, that would be great.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would read on line 1.6, delete installation of and insert a water permit has been granted, and line 1.7, delete a new well.
Members, any questions on the verbal amendment? Okay, seeing thumbs up. So to the verbal amendment to incorporate into the D4, the A1, I would ask that all those in favor of said verbal amendment please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. I'm going to try this again. Are we at that point that you can speak to the bill as amended?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. Thank you to the members of the committee and to the stakeholders who have been actively engaged in getting this policy right so that we can fix the problem that we discussed. I think it was a week ago, and we've gotten to a pretty good place. I'm sure we're going to get additional public testimony to this, but I appreciate the work that has been done to this point. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Members, I'm just going through this, and it appears that I missed a step as we amended the DE4 and the A1, and we did not adopt the A1. Any questions since that was complicated? All right. To the A1, all those in favor of adopting the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I spoke too soon when I thought that we were done with that. Go ahead and proceed, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With desire to be very, very brief, we took the bill from last week and we put in additional restrictions and guidelines and guardrails so that we are really tailoring this to a very, very narrow scope for the people who are very directly impacted by the current prohibition from use. And so I'm excited about where we're at today, and I would look forward to our testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Looks like Mr. Meckel is coming back. Is that correct? Mr. Meckel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Jason Meckel, Assistant Division Director, Ecological and Water Resources at the DNR. We appreciate the author's work on this bill. We do not have any concerns with the revised, adopted, amended language that you all just agreed to, and we just want to say we also appreciate the efforts to deal with the potable use definition and getting this language to be better in alignment with other statutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Ms. Griffith, if I have that correct, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carly Griffith. I'm the Water Program Director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I'm here today to testify on House File 4019. Which seeks to amend a 2021 statutory prohibition on uses of the Mount Simon-Hinckley aquifer to allow limited agricultural irrigation uses in a defined geographic area at the aquifer's northern extent. I want to briefly reflect on the fact that back on March 12th, when a delete all amendment was heard to this bill, a colleague of mine testified against an amendment that we thought risked the entire idea of special protections for the legitimate endangered portion of the aquifer, but we think that the bill language before you today is a much more reasonable solution to a localized need for agricultural irrigation for several reasons. First, the bill restricts irrigation to the aquifer's northern extent, and there is a map in a committee handout which shows that this is where the Mount Simon aquifer begins to erode away to expose the less endangered Hinckley aquifer beneath it, which is much shallower and has good recharge characteristics compared to the Mount Simon. So we think that limited agricultural uses are defensible in this extent. If there are any further concerns that need to be addressed, we will continue to work with the bill author as this moves forward to ensure that the Mount Simon-Hinckley aquifer is protected and able to provide clean, safe drinking water for future generations. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Berg, next on my list. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Heintzman, Chair Fisher, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on HF 4019 bill. My name is Jim Berg. I'm a retired Minnesota DNR hydrogeologist and principal investigator for extensive Mount Simon-Hinckley aquifer investigations from 2008 through 2015. I also authored the DNR County Hydrogeologic Atlases for Sherburne, Isanti, Kennebec, Pine, and Carlton counties. I support the HF 4019 bill before us today. Our Mount Simon Hinckley research confirmed what had already been suspected, that this large, high-quality resource had very limited recharge across its southern extent, approximately Wright, Anoka, and Northern Washington County south to the Iowa border, and so that part needed to be used carefully. Let's call that the limited area. The limited recharge is caused mostly by the position of the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer at the bottom of a stack of geologic formations that are in a large geologic basin or bowl-shaped part of the earth. At the northern edge of this bowl, in Sherburn, Isanti, and Chisago counties, most of the stack of geologic formations has long ago been eroded away, leaving the Mount Simon and Hinckley sandstones as relatively shallow buried bedrock aquifers with moderate to high recharge characteristics in local areas. Let's call these three counties the transition area. The region north of Kennebec, Isanti, and Pine-Chisago County borders is out of the basin, and the Mount Simon is eroded at that location, exposing the Hinckley sandstone. Let's call this the northern area. Based on GIS modeling and groundwater chemistry, moderate to very high recharge characteristics are very common in this area. Agricultural irrigation should certainly be allowed in the northern area. I also agree that irrigation permits should be allowed in the transition area because the bill includes the provision for only using the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer if other feasible aquifers are not available. In many cases, other aquifers will be available in that transition area. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Anyone else in the audience that wanted to testify today that wasn't signed up? Not seeing any hands. Members? Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heitzman. I want to say thank you to Representative Schultz for doing the work. There was obviously a way to get to yes here, and I appreciate the way that you engaged the parties across the board to make sure that we were keeping it narrowly focused for where the real concern was. So thank you for your additional work.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Schultz, I have a couple questions. One on the A1 amendment that was adopted on the 1.5 through 1.7. So if, as the author, is it your intent that if there is a positive result that comes, so we're testing for the presence, if there's a positive, is this a one-and-done test, or would you be, is it your intent that there would be continued testing to measure if those contaminants show up?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, especially as the 2021 author of the protection for the Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer. What I see in the A1 amendment is this ability for us to gain a picture as to the health of the aquifer. My intention is what is written in the amendment. That is my intention, and it can inform future policymaking from there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, you know, sometimes the other body has different language. Mm-hmm. And I think the A1 amendment was really important for a lot of our members. And I think there would be trouble coming back if it's not there. So I just want to encourage that, you know, the testing for quality is really important.
Representative Schultz, I didn't hear a question.
Yeah, I will respond to it, though, Mr. Chair. I am very committed to working in a way where what we do this year to get this across the finish line with the assistance of my colleagues on the Democrat side of the aisle, that what we do here, we do well, that we do right, that it is sound, that it is based in data and science, and that we're protecting this resource for future generations. I'm committed to that, and I think that I will need some of your assistance to get this right over in the Senate. So to the extent in which I can deputize you, I would certainly appreciate your help. And on top of that, this gets us, Representative Hansen, this gets us an opportunity to see the health of the aquifer in this location. And I think that that is a good thing for Minnesotans.
Members, any more questions? I am not seeing any more. Representative Schultz, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I'm renewing my motion to send this bill to the General Register. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz motions that House File 4019, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? You're on your way, Representative Schultz. Now, we're going to move members down to House File, my bill, 4257. So.
All right, Co-Chair Heintzman, I believe your motion is to move that House File 4257 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
That is my motion.
And I see you have an author's amendment. Any one amendment? Would you like to move that now?
I would.
All right, members. Co-Chair Heintzman moves that author's amendment, A1 amendment, to get the bill in the shape he would like it for today's discussion. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye. Opposed?
Come on, guys.
Motion carries. All right, the bill is before the The bill is before the committee. Please proceed, Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, this has been an ongoing conversation, and today again, we're going to talk a little bit about the reporting timeline for products that contain PFAS, and it would extend that reporting timeline from July 1st, 2026 to July 1st of 2027. As you've all heard previously, there was a number of reporting issues that those having to work through that process on this PRISM software had shared their concern over. And they're working, had been at least attempting to work with PCA on that reporting database. And in case you're tracking it, I believe we're on our third version or update, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that in testimony in just a moment. So I want to be very clear that this bill is not about rolling back regulation. This is about giving PCA a little more time to get the reporting database right. And I think that over the course of the testimony that you're going to hear today, you'll be reasonably compelled. You'll understand a little bit better, I hope, what those folks that are trying to navigate PRISM are up against. And so that is the intro to my bill and to the amendment today.
All right, thank you, Chair Heintzman. With that, we'll go to testifiers. First up, we have Tom Johnson from MP. Oh, do we have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the amendment. I want to make sure that we're deleting Section 2 from page 2, but not Section 2 from the remainder of the bill. So does it feels like the rest of the bill is Section 2. So
here we go.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 2 would be completely eliminated. The only remaining portion of the bill would be Section 1, excluding the lines on 2.14 through 2.16.
So it's Section 2, page 2, 3, 4, 5,
etc. Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Okay, are we good? To our testifiers now, Tom Johnson from MPCA. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Director of Government Relations and External Affairs for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. First of all, I want to thank Chair Heintzman for the A1 amendment that narrows the scope of the bill to a more simple year extension of the reporting deadline in Section 116.943. The MPCA does have a web page where we've chronicled the various improvements that we've made so far, and Chair Heintzman is referencing some of those. I believe that link has been shared with the committee if folks want to reference that, but this includes many of the biggest asks from manufacturers as laid out both in their January letter to the commissioner that I think is in your packets, and also the spreadsheet that was referenced in our previous February hearing. We've addressed component lists, drop-down menus. We've added chemicals to the list, provided additional guidance as requested, some of that on very specific topics and edge cases, but we're happy to do that. We also are working directly with technical staff at several of the companies that who have identified issues that they want to continue to work with us on. We're happy to continue to do that. At this moment, the agency does not feel that a year extension is necessary. And we have concerns that delaying reporting could impact our timelines for the next phase of implementing AMARA's law, the rules for currently unavoidable use, or CUU. We've also heard from the business community that regulatory certainty on the CUU process is needed as soon as possible for them to make future decisions on their product timelines. So a one-year delay puts the agency at odds with that effort to move things forward for that part of the process. I will wrap up by saying we do want to make this process the least burdensome we can, and I want to thank Chair Heintzman for the conversations about what the agency can do administratively to make that process better for everybody. We're looking at the options that we have to address remaining concerns. As we referenced previously, we do have the option to extend the timeline if necessary. We are working on additional guidance that some of which is coming out this month still, and we're working on clearer guidance on compliance, so more to come on that front. We're also planning on tutorial videos and other resources, open office hours for folks as we get closer to the implementation timeline. So we're happy to keep working with companies and are continuing to do that. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. Of course, happy to stand for questions. I also have Assistant Commissioner Kirk Kadelka with us to help me with additional details too. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Director Johnson. I think we'll hold for questions till after the testifiers. Just reminding everyone that we have 2 minutes for testifiers. And up next will be Martha, and forgive me if I get names wrong, Martha Marapiece. Did I get it? Could you introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for pronouncing my name for the record. I am Martha Marapiece, and I am general counsel to the Complex Products Manufacturers Coalition, CPMC, from here forward. CPMC is in support of HRF 4257 as amended. The organization represents a broad cross-section of products essential for health, safety, and the functioning of society. Complex durable goods serve nearly every major section of the nation, providing critical and often life-saving services. They include appliances, electronics, space and water heating, refrigeration, air conditioning, ventilation, regulated engines, outboard motors, lighting, security, power tools and equipment, electric power generation, communication devices, vehicles, vessels, and their components and replacement parts. Complex durable goods are defined by EPA, Vermont, and New Mexico as products that are manufactured composed of 100 or more manufactured components with an intended useful life of 5 or more years, where the product is typically not consumed, destroyed, or discarded after a single use. It's a long lifespan products. In January, CPMC spearheaded a letter to Commissioner Kessler to notify her of deficiency in the website tool that were being encountered by some of our members during the beta testing period. The need for additional time is being felt on our end rather than MPCA's, but be clear that this is a tool that's being built even as it's being used. As a one-size-fits-all tool, it needs to competently handle large submissions as well as simple small-scale reports alike. Even if the PRISM system were 100% complete today, companies need more time than 5 months. Is that my time?
No, your time's
okay.
Up. If you could wrap things up, please.
I would thank the committee for the time that we have. I'll direct you to my written comments and allow you to move on. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Heidi Adelsman from Alliance of Nurses for a Healthy Environment. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Heidi Adelsman. I'm with the Nurses, the Alliance of Nurses for a Healthy Environment, and I'm here as a nurse to talk about how my patients and I are affected by PFAS exposure and why we need to not delay the reporting required in Amara's Law one more year. Daily, nurses spike bags of IV antibiotics and fluids, all which expose us to PFAS and increase our risk of cancer and other diseases. I've learned such packaging exposing us to PFAS is banned in California. So there's hope in the industry's innovation with technology already in place. Working in healthcare in 2006 with children who have cancer at the University of Minnesota, I asked a patient whose T-shirt said, "Cancer sucks. Where did you get that?" She said there were others from her Tartan High School in Oakdale who have cancer. This is when I learned about the high rates of cancer in Washington County. The young woman had osteosarcoma, a rare bone cancer where her leg had to be amputated, and she later died. Soon after, I met MPCA research scientist and coordinator of the Emerging Contaminant Program, Fardeen Oliai, who first reported extremely high levels of PFAS contamination in fish in the year 2000 in the Mississippi River near 3M. Had Minnesota not delayed further testing of groundwater, wells, lakes, and rivers, then maybe Tartan High School would not be one of the largest donors to the American Cancer Society's Relay for Life in the Nation. Instead, in 2006, Oliai was silenced and forced out of her job as the commissioner, a past 3M executive, Cheryl Corrigan, forced her out. According to the MPCA in their 2023 groundbreaking study, they show the unaffordable cost of PFAS cleanup from wastewater underscores the need to reduce the use of forever chemicals. Currently, PFAS can be bought for $50 to $1,000 per pound, but to remove and destroy PFAS from municipal wastewaters costs between $2.7 to $18 million per pound and will total $14 to $28 billion over 20 years to clean up. This does not include the cost and impact on human health to families paying for futile treatments and more. Consumers deserve to know what's in the products they buy for their children. Today, as Minnesotans are told industry needs yet more time, we ask how many more children dying of cancer are we, as families and nurses, expected to care for? The sooner Amara's Law is fully enacted, the sooner industry will get it done. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Andrew Morley, Director of Environmental Policy for the Chamber. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Co-Chair Fisher and Co-Chair Heinzman, my name is Andrew Morley, and I work for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide trade association representing more than 6,300 businesses and a half million employees. We also serve as the state affiliate for the National Association of Manufacturers. Thank you to Chairman Heinzman for introducing HF 4257, a bill moving back the reporting deadline for PFAS in products. The legislature in 23 passed a law requiring, among other things, reporting for PFAS in products. The initial deadline was January of this year, but because the system was not yet ready, it was moved back administratively to July of 26. Last month, this committee heard from witnesses from diverse industries detailing their struggles with the PRISM system, which launched only this past January. The MPCA argued the system was working as it should, but also testified that improvements are still being made and PRISM will be in a continual testing mode. That hearing occurred with 132 days remaining to the deadline. Today, with now 99 days to go until July 1, PRISM is still not ready to process the sheer amount of incoming data and deal with confidential business information, among other shortcomings. Today, I'll detail a couple of challenges that persist. For example, manufacturers with diverse suppliers for the same part receive inconsistent information from different global suppliers. Data entries for that part in PRISM are therefore either duplicative or contradictory. The use and interpretation of data for confidential business information is still not yet resolved 33 days later. The Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse, which is used for other chemical reporting systems, has never been asked to take in information as vast and sensitive as what PRISM is charged with doing. Further, system crashes, inconsistency in user guides, and frequently asked question documents and a flawed reporting group mechanism were also complaints at PRISM's launch, at the hearing 33 days ago, and today with 99 days remaining until the administration's reporting deadline. PRISM has made improvements. Free text typing in some menus and allowing manufacturers to request adding new types are a small step forward, but systemic problems remain. HF 4257 is not a repeal. It does not pave the way for noncompliance. It simply delays the deadline and gives the 23 law an opportunity to function by creating a window for manufacturers to better prepare and allow the agency the time required to make the necessary systemic changes. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Morley. Next up, we have Amanda Dewar. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Amanda Dewar, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, representing the state's new motor vehicle dealers. I'm here to express our strong support for House File 4257. You've heard a lot about the challenges of the prison system and the need for a one-year delay, so I'm going to focus elsewhere. Asking manufacturers to report on products manufactured on or after the reporting date is vitally important to the automotive industry. You may or may not realize that dealerships have large part warehouses that supply our service departments. When customers bring in their vehicles for maintenance or repair, they expect us to have the parts needed to complete the job. And not everyone has a vehicle that was manufactured in the past few years when manufacturers were tracking PFAS content. Take someone needing a replacement drive belt on a 2018 sedan. PFAS wasn't on anybody's radar back then. The supply chain data doesn't exist. How are manufacturers supposed to report on these legacy products? The answer from MPCA is keep looking. But what happens when the answer isn't found? Will these parts need to be pulled from our shelves? Will Minnesotans still be able to get their vehicles repaired? The MPCA likes to say they focus on education, but they do have the statutory authority to stop sales. So trust us on this isn't good enough. We're not saying that PFAS are not harmful chemicals. We're not asking the legislature to roll back any standards, but we are asking the MPCA to realize that there are legacy products out there where PFAS data simply isn't available. Having a manufactured on or after date just makes common sense. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Ivana Stark. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ivana Stark, State Director of Clean Water Action Minnesota, and we have thousands of members across the state who care about their health, the environment, and our future. On behalf of our members, we oppose House File 4257 because it's an expensive delay that will cost Minnesotans. A few months ago in this committee, we heard a lot of fear-mongering from billion-dollar industries about how hard it would be to fill out. These same industries that claim the ability to solve all of our problems are fussing over an online form that hasn't even fully launched yet. You will hear from all of them the things that they can't do, the things that they can't figure out, and I find it hard to believe that these million-dollar industries can't be job creators and hire a team to understand their supply chain and learn how to properly report on a website. Industry knows that they can slow down implementation of MARA's law, then they can slow it down in other states following our lead. Industry sees that there is a global trend to move away from the use of forever chemicals, and bills like this are simply an attempt to slow down the momentum Minnesota has created that is focused on protecting your health and our environment. My husband and I are small business owners. He's an appliance repair technician and has been for over 20 years. We see firsthand the appliance manufacturers adjusting to conform and comply with the law. In 2023, they said MARA's law would ruin the industry, but it hasn't. We see manufacturers knowing exactly what components are in their appliances and making the changes needed so that they can safely and legally sell products in Minnesota. If they know what is in the products to sell here, they know what is in their products to report here. I can guarantee you that my husband knows every piece of every appliance that he works on. He knows the manufacturers, the distributors, and he knows how to track down obscure parts and fix older, rare machines. If my husband can understand which components are in compliance or how to determine how to figure out which components are in compliance, so can these companies with way more profits in a year than we will ever see in our lifetime. I'll also let you in on a secret. When we tell customers that we have to switch to a new component to avoid PFAS, they're grateful. They feel we're looking out for their health and safety because they don't want these toxic chemicals in their homes or around their families. Did you know that many ice makers and fridges are coated with PFAS to help the ice slide out? So you may be getting a side of forever chemicals with your ice maker. So in short, this panic really needs to stop. The sky is not falling, and we do urge a no vote. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Malika Butler, the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. Could you introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Co-chairs Heitzman and Fisher, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Malika Butler. I'm a state affairs director with the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, representing automakers that produce nearly 95% of the cars and light trucks sold in the U.S. Let me begin with this. Our industry supports the intent and the spirit of MARA's law. We share the goal of reducing exposure to harmful chemicals and advancing a safer, more sustainable future. We have engaged in this process in good faith from the beginning and remain committed to compliance. We strongly support HF 4257 because it restores regulatory certainty. I've detailed our positions on the various provisions in this bill in my written testimony, but I wanted to take the time today to outline the real-time impacts the industry is assessing under the current framework and the market impacts that may follow. Auto innovators detailed challenges during the February 19th implementation hearing hosted by this body, and we want to acknowledge that the PCA has been engaged in working to improve the prison system. However, it's been over a month since that hearing and substantial hurdles remain, and progress has not kept pace with the statutory timeline. The impact of quality data and continued operational deficiencies creates substantial compliance risk for companies acting in good faith. If we don't delay, the risk to consumers begins after July 1st, not before. Compliance is not a one-time event, but the start of an ongoing and uncertain process. We're appreciative of the agency's willingness to be flexible and continue working with the regulated community. However, flexibility and without clearly defined parameters does not reduce risk. It introduces additional uncertainty, which then becomes a market issue. And that poses real consequences for Minnesota consumers. Unclear compliance expectations may lead manufacturers to make the straightforward business decision to limit distribution into Minnesota to manage risk, ultimately reducing the availability of replacement parts. And when parts are delayed or unavailable, the consequences are immediate. Longer repair times, higher costs, and disrupted mobility for families and workers who rely on their vehicles for jobs, school, medical care, and other essential needs. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, is the ongoing uncertainty can influence the broader supply decisions, potentially leading to fewer vehicles available in the state and reduced inventory options. Thank you for the time to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we just wanted to acknowledge that this is a necessary path forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Tony Quillis. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing the Consumer Technology Association, better known as CTA. It's a trade association that represents technology companies that include small and medium manufacturers and retailers that sell electronic products throughout the United States. And I thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House File 4257 to extend the date for manufacturers to comply with reporting to the state of Minnesota on PFAS in their products. As you've heard previously in this committee and again today, the reporting page regarding products, product categories, missing chemical definitions, and the complete crashing of the website itself at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the PRISM system is troubling to the business industry. Another large concern is once the data is actually able to be entered is the protection of the proprietary information or confidential business information. The PCA says that it will be protected under Chapter 13, but there's no guarantee that that data is going to be classified or protected. The deadline has already been extended once from January 1st to July 1st because the agency realized they weren't going to be able to meet the January 1st deadline, and we're also already on the third version of this. Additionally, the updated guidance documents have not been published, and this is before we get to the extension and waiver requests that are going to be filed that are going to add to the situation and make it more complicated. Businesses want to comply with this law and need to comply with this law, but the uncertainty that the tight timelines have created right now that surround this PRISM system creates confusion among the regulated community. I think it would be smart to allow the agency, along with input now from folks that are starting to try and get into this PRISM system, to establish an adequate reporting system so that we can move forward and meet all the laws that we are required to do.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, members, we'll proceed to discussion questions. Members? Sydney. Oh, sorry. Representative Jordan.
Sydney's fine, Mr. Chair. I had some questions for the MPCA.
Director Johnson? Okay, Representative Jordan.
Thank you. So, Mr. Johnson, thanks for being here. This is the first I'm hearing about a crash on the website. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Tom Johnson, Government Relations, MPCA. Representative, my understanding is there, to my knowledge, have been no crashes of the PRISM system. I'm not sure if there's a misunderstanding of what exactly an error message is, but it's really my understanding the only thing that somebody has encountered with the system is when they've tried to upload their template, there's been an error message because there's been one of the cells that hasn't been completed properly, or there's been a macro on the back end or something. But to my knowledge, there have been zero crashes of the PRISM system.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you. And then we also heard a lot of concerns about data privacy and trade secrets. Obviously, the MPCA does that with a lot of different things. Can you talk about how, we're not the Judiciary Committee, but I know a lot of MPCA bills end up going through the Judiciary Committee because of those Chapter 13 references. Can you talk about how you protect trade secrets, what experience the MPCA has with that, and other data?
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Jordan. Yes, as you referenced, we deal with trade secrets all the time. I will say we addressed this, I think, at the last hearing quite a bit, but the system does not automatically publish any data. So when a report comes through, it sits until we have the opportunity to affirmatively publish the data. So if somebody makes a trade secret request, then we are able to assess that, make a decision, and then publish the data. Those decisions would be made on a case-by-case basis, as they normally are for trade secret information, if they apply to the criteria within Section 13. The other piece that we've made into the reporting system is if somebody has a trade secret request or assertion, there's an option in the system where they can, for example, with a specific chemical, if they believe it's a trade secret, to list the specific chemical name, for example, a proprietary chemical name, they can move it up to a higher class of chemicals within PFAS. They can say it's part of a larger subclass of PFAS, and that protects the specific trade secret nature of that particular chemical. So we've built those pieces into our system.
All right, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I guess I will just say that, Minnesota is a leader in this. Other states have, we all go to these conferences and things, but I get emails and talk to legislators all the time who ask how we can do this. And one of the things we talked about is have an agency that pays attention to these things. Are there any other things in this process that the agency has learned from this process of standing up this PRISM system? So when people are asking about it, this is kind of a first of its kind entity, but you've put a lot of work into it. So are there any lessons that you've learned at the MPCA about this? And that's it.
Director Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's a great question. I think one of the things is it is an entirely new. There's the new MOA, but they stand up this high priority chemicals database system already in other states, and so one lesson learned was to use a vendor who knows what they're doing already with that type of reporting system. And has experience implementing changes based on the needs of industry. So that was a big thing. I think for us, maybe more clarity about what the different timelines were. I think, we had our early launch. Maybe we could have called that an alpha, and now we're in the beta. Or, I don't know if what the clarity should have been, but I think folks are saying there's an issue because we're continuing to improve the system while we lead up to the compliance date. And so I think we're in some cases caught a little off guard by the fact that making improvements is actually, a concern to some folks. But so maybe some more clarity in how we rolled out the system. I think there's always room for improvement there. And we're certainly taking into account all the feedback that we received, and happy to pass along that to anybody else who wants to put these laws into place. But the other intention here is that this PRISM system can be used for other states, and that's why we've used the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse and the new MOA system so that everybody can use it potentially if they want to pass a law of their own.
Representative Heitzman, executive comment.
Thank you, Chair Buerkle. There was a couple of questions there, Representative Jordan, and I'd like to give Mr. Quillis an opportunity to address a few of those things also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Jordan, and to Mr. Johnson, when we talk about crashing, I think I'm not a techie, but when we talk about crashing, we talk about the error messages, things that when people would go through and in the middle of putting in this prescriptive and broad data where they would have to walk away from the computer and come back and have to reload everything that goes through there. In terms of the data privacy, there's no timeline now for the agency. Once I've submitted and say that I'd like this to be a trade secret information, that's public data. And when then the agency makes that decision where there's no timeline on that, now we've got that uncertainty sitting there and there's no recourse for the business or possible, you know, could lead to possible litigation and how we're gonna go through this. And I'll give you the perfect example. When we went and did the paint stewardship program that I'm sure that Representative Hansen remembers, we specifically called out in there trade secret information and sales information as it's defined under Chapter 13 submitted to the commissioner are private and public data. And so there's an example right there that I think the agency can use to go through to give the business community some certainty when we talk about going through with trade secret information, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, information that has been, until a decision is made, information that has been requested to be classified as trade secret is non-public data until a decision is made, just to be 100% clear.
All right. Anything else? All right, Representative Godfrey, you're next up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this discussion. I also have a question for Mr. Johnson, so stay where you're at. We heard a little bit earlier about some concern over how, I think they called it legacy materials or legacy products would be handled, and defining legacy products as those that are don't have data about the PFAS in them. I don't actually know if that is language that is utilized within the bill of legacy products or anything like that, but let's go with it for the purposes of this question. So in a scenario in which PFAS data is not available, such as in those legacy products, how would the NPCA handle that?
Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is an excellent question, Representative. I think we tried to address some of this in the bill language originally, or the legislature had some resale exemption here in the bill in one section. But what I think the folks are especially and have been raised by the automotive industry is a legitimate issue of, I think, where you have products that, for example, for an old model of a vehicle that you're still selling replacement parts for, and they might be sold by a different vendor or they might be diffuse to the point where it's difficult to account for all of them. So I think this is one thing we're still working on for guidance, but what we have already in guidance is, I think, where we've tried to address both this type of issue and just supply chain issues in general, which is that, explicitly, what if information from my supply chain is incomplete or I can't find it? The answer that we have in guidance is report the information you have obtained by the reporting deadline using the options allowed in the reporting system. Continue to request information and make updates as required to your report as new information becomes available. Maintain documentation of these continued efforts to obtain all relevant PFAS information from your supply chain. So essentially, report what you have, continue to request it and keep your receipts that you've been doing that. And those are the requirements in the rule. So if you cannot obtain that information, we've accounted for that in the guidance.
All right, Representative Godfrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that answer. So that also That is written in within Amara's Law, the statute that you have. The MPCA has the ability to, issue that guidance and make those judgment calls on a case by case basis. Is that correct,
Director Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The statute requires us, as is the case with a number of very complicated laws, that we go to the rules and we create a structure. So the legislature gave us the authority and direction to adopt rules, and then those rules clarify to a certain degree, and then we also have guidance that essentially is an interpretation of how certain pieces, very specific pieces, will be implemented. So it's all on how you get to implementing a specific law, where the legislature is giving us a framework, and then we have to interpret it first by rules, and then more specifically by some guidance.
All right, Representative Godfrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just more of a comment just to wrap up. I appreciate that answer. That is the purpose of rulemaking authority. And I will say that, so I'll just reiterate kind of what I said last time, is that I trust industry to do what they can to protect their bottom line, to protect their pocketbook. It is incumbent upon us as legislators to make sure that we are protecting people, not just the bottom line, not just our pocketbook. And at the same time, it is incumbent upon agencies to effectuate the laws that we have effectively. Now, I'm hearing about implementing a one-year delay as far as this bill. As far as I can tell, there's been a delay of a couple of months, several months. And I don't know that a several-month delay warrants a one-year delay in statute. I think the particular usage of the word crashing indicates, at least to me, maybe a selective exaggeration of what actually happened, which does kind of raise some red flags for me as to industry's motives in talking about this. So I appreciate the continued conversation. I look forward to the agency getting it right, and I look forward to compliance when the agency decides that people need to comply. Thank you.
All right, next up, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of what I had to say has been said, so I'll just add, this is Amara's Law's historic work that we should be proud of, and we should be bolstering and not trying to delay or decay because of economic hardships are real, so are the consequences of, cancer and losing your loved ones. So more protection, not less.
Next up, Representative Gilman, then I have Purcell, and then we need to kind of move along if we can. So Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Werkle. And my question is for the MPCA really quickly. I can't recall how many more FTEs that you hired in 2023. How many more do you anticipate you're going to need to implement and to receive all this data and to do the work? How many more full-time employees are you going to need at MPCA to manage all this information coming in?
Director Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Gilman, I believe it was 4 or 5 FTE. I'm happy to follow up with the specific number, but that was the fiscal note, I believe, and I'll follow up with more specific. But we have that team working on it right now, and then the vendor at NUMOA has staff dedicated to technical issues with the system. So we believe prepared for managing this system. I think there's always, if a lot of additional customer service is desired by industry and a lot of individual attention, we could certainly work with our partners there to advocate for additional resources at the agency if they would like that. I think we feel like we have what we need right now to keep the system running and to follow up on specific issues and implement the law.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you. And my last follow-up comment is just to the to our committee here. There's lots of letters of support in here for House File 4257, and I took time to read several of these. Again, it's not about protecting corporations. This is about the people. What are we thinking about for Minnesotans when we know that, you know, our vehicles are changing, you know, technology is changing? If we are going to be the only outlier in the entire nation that is going to be requiring, you know, to make it more difficult to have these products in our state, the impacts are going to be felt with the supply, you know. And again, I just think this needs more time, more effort. We're seeing, again, with the amount of work that is going to be required to do things, for what reason? Is it going to change the outcome of what people are using? So I'm just hope we can take more time with this. Thanks.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just a couple of comments. I want to thank all the people who came to testify. Thanks for coming back again. It's a little bit unusual that we just relitigate the same bill twice in the same session. I'm not hearing a ton of new information. I'm glad to hear that businesses are excited to comply, because the law as it stands, it was the manufacturing of a product on or before January 1st, 2026, that's already come and gone. So we're talking about a year and a half delay, moving a law that's already there. I did hear the words regulatory certainty, and to me it seems like pretty certain this is already the law, and then we're whoopsies changing our mind. So clearly I'm not in favor of this right now, but I will just say to our local industries, I said this last year, and I believe in innovation, and I believe that our people are coming up with solutions and alternatives, and I look forward to supporting those. And to the MPCA, I will maybe come down on the other side of things and say, at times I wish you were less permissive and less flexible, because there's a ton of scenarios where you have been allowing more time. And I hope that everyone is coming to the table as a good faith actor, and I believe that the agency has. And I hope that that is not being taken advantage of. Thank you for more interesting discussion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, Chair Heintzman, would you like to close out your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's a couple of things I just wanted to mention, and that I heard from members through this conversation. And I'll just start with Representative Purcell. Yes, we are relitigating this to a point. It's because it's a really, really big deal. And if we don't get this right, our constituents, to Representative Godfrey's point, I think I heard you say, Representative Godfrey, that it's incumbent upon us to protect the people. And we all agree. There's different concerns that we're trying to address this issue over. And part of that is here we are. Most people in the state of Minnesota don't even know about this law. And at a very certain point in history, or future, excuse me, it's going to affect them when it comes to the products and when it comes to the parts that they need to keep their cars going, their tractors, their electronic devices. And when they come to us and say, why didn't you fix this before it became a problem? That's us in this room at this table. I'm trying to do that. That's why I brought it back again today. Because I keep hearing, oh, on one hand, don't worry about it, it's all going to be fine. PCA says it's going to be fine. But what I heard from Director Johnson was, we believe, ready. That's not good enough when we are talking about such an impactful problem coming here to Minnesota. And so I'm trying to get to the issue with this bill and give us a little more time. As I opened, I said we are not rolling back any specific regulation or protection in terms of the ultimate end goal of Amara's Law. We're trying to give folks the time they need to get through this process with a software that hasn't been working very good. And it, we can just hear what we want to hear, or we can try to address it. I'm trying to address it. So I hope that we can do that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that this file, House File 4257, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
All right. Co-Chair Heintzman renews his motion that 4257, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. The bill is laid over. All right, Chair Heintzman, I see you have another bill. We're going to House File 4149. Co-Chair Heintzman, would you like to move your bill?
I would move that House File 4149 be re-referred to the General Register. And I do have a author's amendment. And I'm hoping that we could discuss the bill and possibly address that as we have some more discussion.
All right. All right. Chair Heintzman, would you like to move your amendment and then we'll...
I would. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Heintzman would like to move the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
We're going to have some discussion on that first. Oh. Representative Jordan.
Is it just the A1 amendment? I think my packets are a little bit. I think I found it, but is it just an A1 amendment? Okay, thank you.
Correct. Chair Heintzman has moved the A1 amendment, but we're going to go right into discussion. Would you like to just open up the A1 amendment for us,
Chair Heintzman? I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, as introduced, is a agency technical and housekeeping bill. We hear that a lot around here. There are minimal issues addressed in the bill. I'll just mention the A1 quickly. As we heard, the A1, it's trying to get at some recent difficulties that ag landowners and operators are experiencing, particularly in northern Minnesota in qualifying for agricultural land exemptions under Minnesota's Wetland Conservation Act. So hopefully we all now have that amendment in front of us, out of our packets, and I'm hoping that there can be some discussion quickly and we'll be able to get through this and get to a conclusion. Looks like Chair Fisher has a few thoughts.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Burkle. Chair Heintzman, if we could get the Bowser to come up and talk it through, from my understanding, they're the ones that put the language together and to identify the problem, why we're seeing it, how it's coming forward, et cetera.
Executive Director Jasky, could you introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm the Chair and members, John Jasky, Executive Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. If you'd like, I could speak to the proposed amendment.
Could you put, yeah, closer to the mic, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, as the Chair Heintzman mentioned, in 2024, we passed legislation through this committee that did an attempt, and a solid attempt, at aligning our state law on agricultural lands and wetland protections that we had in the law with what is already in place at the federal level, through something called the Federal Farm Program, and specifically a provision that is referred to as Swamp Buster. It's been around since 1985, okay, and it's been evolved slowly and predictably for the last, I guess, 40 years nearly. What happened is in 2024, at the same time, or near about the same time, a court case, a federal court case, set aside a large swath of all of the determinations that USDA NRCS had made for producers that the state was going to be relying on for the local decisions that are going to align with that. And so that's the first thing that happened. The second thing that happened has been, in the last year or so, the number of staff who would have to go and redo those determinations that the USDA has been depleted substantially, with specifically their compliance staff. And so now we're having producers who previously were able to get relatively rapid decisions from USDA and not able to do that. And there's also, I should point out, particularly in northern Minnesota, as Chair Heintzman mentioned, There are a much lower number of people who participate in the Federal Farm Program, and USDA used to provide this service to them as well, because there's just been, people could come in and out of the program. We wanted to make sure they were compliant if they were going to go back in. They no longer are doing that. So this amendment is trying to do basically a couple of things, and both of them aimed at retaining the same level of protection or similar level of protection we have now. I can walk through just a bit more, Mr. Chair and members, if you'd like, line by line. In the first portion of it, in lines 1.6 to 1.116, what we're doing there is simply referring to the date that is in the legislation, the federal legislation that is being stricken on line 1.13. So that December 23rd, 1985 date is the date of that effective provision in that federal program that says you can keep what you had in terms of drainage before that date, but after that date, you basically have to either avoid draining or you have to only do maintenance, or if you're going to go beyond that, you have to do some mitigation. The second piece of this then is down in line 1.17 through 1.24. And this is in here as an alternative approach, similar to what we had in statute prior to these 2024 changes, that acknowledges that there are certain areas that are being farmed and have historically been farmed. And this allows them to do, you know, drainage maintenance or drainage installation on those landscapes that previously didn't have it, if they can meet this test of having been farmed 8 of 10 years. The third change, and this is on lines 2.17 and 2.18, this is just putting into statute something that already exists. And we have an agreement with USDA to allow ag producers, farmers to provide offsets through wetland banking, and they do this into a special established ag wetland bank that only allows landscapes or landowners who have ag land to put credits in, and to only allow farmers and other landowners who own ag land to use those credits. And so that's been set up, and it's in a cooperative agreement with USDA. This language is helpful. It obviously can function without it, but it's helpful to allow it to continue into statute if down the road changes were made at the administrative level. And then the last piece is on lines 2.22 through the remainder of that page. This is simply putting in place a mechanism for the public drainage authorities who are doing maintenance on their drainage systems to meet the test of the exemption. So the standard is not being changed. It's just being clear that they can accomplish the standard by record keeping rather than having to do a wetland delineation and more elaborate and expensive scientific investigation in some cases. We get the same level of protection, but this would be clear then for those systems what they could use for documentation to claim the exemption. And Mr. Chair, I'll end there.
All right. Chair Fisher, we left off with you. We do have two more testifiers, but go ahead. Okay, let's do that. I think next up we have Sheila Vanney. Could you identify yourself for the committee and proceed?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Sheila Vanney, Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. I want to thank the Board of Water and Soil Resources for working with us on the underlying bill, making those technical changes, some housekeeping work on the language there. And then, yes, we do recognize SWCDs across the state are having some challenges with implementing the Wetland Conservation Act ag exemption in particular after the 2024 statutory changes. And this is...
It was the screen, sorry.
Can you hear me okay?
The screen, it just bumped up and they were wondering what was on it. It's not anything to worry about.
Okay, sorry. We appreciate the attention to some of the challenges that have surfaced with regard to implementation of the ag exemption, and look forward to being part of furthering conversations down the road. In particular, I just want to express our support for the provisions in lines 1.17 through 1.24 that kind of enable an off-ramp, if you will, to go back to the previous approach
that was in place before 2024, where there are producers who, for example, are not in the federal farm program or are having challenges with getting a certified wetland determination from the NRCS with the current backlog and staffing challenges. So again, it's not a rollback of protections in any way from our perspective. It's just making the local implementation more manageable. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Ed Arneson from Lake of the Woods County via Zoom, I believe. Ed, can you hear us?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
We got you. Go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the author.
Please identify yourself for the committee and proceed. Sorry.
I'm a Lake of the Woods County Commissioner. I've held this office this is my 26th year. I'm also a farmer. I farmed in Lake of the Woods County for most of my life. I took over my dad's farm. I've been farming since probably about 1975 or active in agriculture. Our concern here is the loss of the exemption. And I just want to explain, this is not a attempt to dismantle WACA. This is a temporary fix while we wait for the backlog of certified wetland determinations to get accomplished on the federal level. Because we are unsure how long it might take, we have put in a sunset so we can all come together to review the progress and see if this exemption is still needed. Without this change, we will be facing a serious problem in our agricultural economy, especially in Lake of the Woods County, where only 3% of the producers have a certified determination. We need to fix this session. Please help us solve this problem and let the conversation continue if there is still more work to be done. We're open to working with anyone who has concerns.
All right, thank you for your testimony. With that, members, any more questions on the A1? Representative Hansen. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Jashke and Chair Heinzman. I think the underlying bill, you know, is very needed. Gets rid of the term land occupiers. When we look at A1, you know, I think concern is unintended consequences, that wetland law is complicated. We have spent years trying to put this together. We've made changes. And as we try to move this relatively quickly, we don't want to make any mistakes. One question I have for Director Jashke on the drainage portion, Section 13, has that been sent to the drainage work group, or have they provided any comment on that?
Director Jess.
Mr. Chair, the drainage work group, which is established in statute and works mostly during the non-legislative months to develop policy and other work, did not, as a group, review this, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen. There are participants who were in that group that had some involvement in it.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Jashke, are they meeting at all in the next couple weeks? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, no, they are not scheduled to meet until after legislative session, probably in June, I think.
Chair Hansen.
And then, Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, the reason we're having this in front of us is because of the destruction of the federal government in terms of USDA and NRCS. Thousands, if not tens of thousands, of employees have been laid off or fired. The people who used to do these things, wasn't magical. It was a choice that happened, and now here we are having to pick up the wreckage. Mm-hmm. And by changing law, we used to try to comply. You know, we always have these compliance bills and conformity bills, but now when you have complete deregulation or attempts at complete deregulation, we have to try to make sure we have the protection. So that's why I think we have caution. That's not to say that we wouldn't support something here in the future. I think that, you know, particularly when you get to the 1.6 to 1.8 portions, looking back over 40 years ago, I mean, half the room wasn't around then. And, you know, how do we keep forward with an evolving information and more science? And that's where I think on the underlying bill, you know, including science in there is really critical. So I know you're working on it. I've talked to Representative Duran, you know, and said, I think we can continue to working on this. You know, I'm not sure what is the path of the bill that you moved.
Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, the idea was let's have a discussion on the A1, which it sounds like there's still concerns that your side has on this, so I'll probably withdraw that. And then if we could move the section that there seems to be agreement to the general register, that'd be great, but I'm open to discussion.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman. I think that, you know, we want to make deadline. I think this portion is important that's in the bill. So if I think I'll defer to Representative Fisher, but I'm supportive of moving the bill out and continuing to work on this and see if we can get something that gives us a little more time. And I don't know, maybe one other question.
Yep, Chair Hansen.
What's the status in the Senate?
Chair Heintzman.
I'll defer to Director Jaski.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's a hearing on the same bill today with the same amendment being considered there.
Yeah. Chair Hansen, you're good.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions to the A1? If not, Chair Fisher, are you good?
Chair Fisher. Thank you, Chair Burkle. Thank you, Chair Heintzman, for bringing up the amendment. It's given us a chance to hear a little bit more on it, and I appreciate the fact that you'll lay it over so we can get the rest of the bill out. And I appreciate the fact that there is willingness to continue discussions on the A1 amendment as we go forward. So thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, Chair Heintzman, to the A1 amendment. Are you withdrawing the A1?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would withdraw the A1, so hopefully we can work on the bill as it was before the committee without the amendment.
Okay, Chair Heintzman has withdrawn the A1 amendment to the underlying bill. Is there any discussion of the underlying bill? If not, we'll proceed to a vote. Any questions for members? Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's go ahead and move this to the general
okay.
register, please.
Chair Heintzman has renewed his motion to re-refer this bill to House File 4149 to the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay. And my bill is up next, House File 3236. I'll turn the gavel over. Here you go.
Vice Chair Burkle, I believe your motion is to move that House File 3236 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3236 to be laid over.
And I see that you have author's DE1 amendment. Would you like to move that now?
I'd like to move the DE1 amendment right now, please. Thank you.
Members, all those in favor of moving the DE1 amendment to House File 3236, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Representative Burkle, your bill is before the committee. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 3236, as amended, simply does a few things. Number one, provides applicants with early access to the DNR, similar to a provision last year that Chair Fisher introduced.
allowing large water users the ability to have early meetings with the DNR to discuss sites and aquifer availability. It also does allows for timely transfer of permits. And also in section 4 of the bill, as amended, allows support for cover crops. The section would allow a permit holder to obtain an additional 1 inch of water above their current allocation to establish a cover crop. And finally, allows greater accountability for timelines for permitting. And with that, Mr. Chair, that's really the guts of the bill. I'd like to go to my testifiers if I could.
Looks like Mr. Meckel is up first, DNR. Mr. Meckel, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Jason Meckel, Assistant Division Director, Ecological and Water Resources at the DNR. Just want to point out for the committee here a couple of things in the bill. One is that the transfer language, I want to just make it clear to everybody that we generally already do transfer permits, and we typically don't make changes on those transfers. Occasionally, we do need to for whatever reasons. And we're not necessarily opposed to this language. But if we have a permit that is transferred, and let's say a week later, a month later, we discover an issue in that geographic area that we need to look at all of the permits, just by transferring the permit does not mean that there is a permanent right or a permanent fixture to that permit. We have the authority, the commissioner has the authority to revisit any permits should we need to at any time. So I just wanted to point that out to the committee that was the case. And then we do have some concerns about the changes about the requirements for aquifer tests. Current statute, as you see it in the bill, says that essentially we can waive that whenever it's not needed, and we do a lot. In previous testimony, I think I've mentioned that we typically only require this about twice a year. They're intensive studies. They require resources, much less our own staff resources, to evaluate them and verify the results and so forth. We don't think this is a necessary provision. We understand it, and fundamentally we'll still require them when we need them, and this gives us the ability to do that. There is one other provision that I did want to point out, and that is that in the latter part of the bill, there's a provision if the commissioner fails to issue or deny the permit in the time period required, the commissioner must refund the applicant all fees charged in connection with the application. However, I just want to point out that in 103G.301 subdivision 4, we are expressly prohibited from refunding any application fees for any permits for any particular reasons. So I'm just pointing out in the language that there's a conflict there with an existing statute. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Broughton.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, members. Darren Broughton, Executive Director of Minnesota AgriGrowth. I want to thank Representative Burkle for his leadership on this important piece of legislation to modernize the DNR's water appropriation permitting program. House File 3236 has been a year-long conversation with numerous stakeholders, the DNR, and I want to say thank you to the DNR for their willingness to engage on this topic, and legislators on both sides of the aisle. This legislation builds on the legislature's decision last year to increase water appropriation permit fees by adding more accountability to the DNR's permitting process. We know that funding without reform rarely improves results. Too many applicants at the DNR, in the permitting process, their permits go into a black hole. Applications get submitted, but decisions for conducting a new aquifer test can take months or even years for a decision to come. Even when test results come back, that analysis of results are stalled or delayed, and it is never clear if or when a decision will be made on that permit. And House File 3236 brings clarity to that process. within 30 days of an application being submitted to the agency, the agency has to determine if a new aquifer test is needed. And if it is, they have to clearly state in writing why it's needed. Again, we're adding accountability to this process. Once those results are entered and submitted, the DNR then has 120 days to make a decision on that permit. But for the first time, this bill adds extra accountability and flexibility. It allows the commissioner an additional 60 days if they cannot meet that deadline because of a court case or federal law or other statutes. And if the DNR cannot complete its work or make that decision within that 150 or 210-day timeline, the applicant can be refunded their fees and costs associated with the permit. Refunding permit fees and costs if an agency fails to act on time is not a new concept. 2023, Pennsylvania's Governor Shapiro implemented that their entire MPCA, or Environmental Protection Agency, has to refund those permit fees and costs if they fail to meet that timeline. As a result, in Pennsylvania, all those backlogs are now gone. And only 5 refunds have been issued since 2023. This has been so successful that New Jersey and Michigan are implementing this as well. And it's California and New York are now looking at this. This is not a bold new concept. These reforms for modernizing our permitting process and giving project proposers and applicants clarity on the decisions and the timelines is a needed improvement. We can protect our valuable groundwater and improve the process at the same time. This is not an either or choice. I encourage you to support House File 3236.
Next up, Mr. Wildman. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Heintzman, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to testify today. My name is Jake Wildman. I'm a third-generation farmer from Glenwood, Minnesota, and I serve as the president of the Irrigators Association of Minnesota. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 3236, specifically Section 4 regarding limited increased water use for cover crop establishment, and Section 2, Subdivision 7, related to water permit transfers. Cover crops have become an increasingly important conservation practice for Minnesota farmers, particularly for those who farm irrigated ground. Our soils require irrigation. That same irrigation makes cover crops even more appealing and effective. Cover crops improve soil water holding capacity, increase biomass and soil structure, and help prevent wind erosion, especially on our lighter, sandier soils. While some of these benefits do not always show up directly on a balance sheet in a single growing season, they are real long-term benefits that build soil resilience and protect our natural resources. Irrigation also allows farmers to grow crops that leave sufficient time and opportunity to establish cover crops. Sometimes that can be a significant challenge in our northern climate. Cover crops are identified by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in a 2025 Minnesota Nutrient Reduction Strategy as a best management practice for improving soil health and reducing nutrient loss. Farmers work every day to balance environmental stewardship, and economic reality. And allowing limited intentional water use for cover crop establishment provides an important tool to help achieve both goals, even when weather and timing are outside of our control. I also want to express strong support for water permit transfer language, included in House File 3236. Over the next 5 to 10 years, a significant amount of farmland in Minnesota will change ownership, either through land sales or generational transfer. Irrigation farmland is bought, sold, and financed based on reasonable expectations that existing Minnesota Department of Natural Resource water permits will transfer when the land use remains the same. A real-world example comes from a member of the Minnesota Irrigators Association who rented a parcel of land for more than 15 years under a water permit that was in good standing. When the landowner passed away, the property went into a trust, and the family worked with a long-term renter to complete the sale. Even though the water permit was already in place, the water use never changed. The farmer was required to go through a lengthy transfer process under temporary status before the permit was ultimately granted as a standard permit. That kind of uncertainty creates unnecessary financial and operational risk for farmers, even when the permit history and land use is well established. If a permit has been in good standing for 10, 20, 30 plus years, transferring that permit to a new owner who is continuing the same use should not trigger changes to the permit. Clear and predictable permit transfers do not increase water use. They simply allow existing permitted use to continue and provide stability for farmers, lenders, and rural communities. Thank you for your time today and your consideration, the opportunity to provide testimony, House File 3236. I appreciate it, and I look forward to discussion.
Members, we're extremely short on time. Is there any burning question that we have to Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is on the transferring the permit. So maybe this is a question for Mr. Meckel. If a landowner changes and the new landowner is a data center, can they use the permit?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and members, I think what you just asked would be a change in the use of the water. So it would be changing from agricultural irrigation to a different category of use. And I think the provision here does not, let me double check that, but I don't think it allows it. I think it's only to change it for, let me see. I'm going to.
Maybe a question that has to be addressed.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to follow up on that. Yep.
Members, we're getting, like I said, extremely close. I don't think we're going to make it to the MPCA bill with 3 minutes to spare. And a reminder that we are laying this bill over. Any more questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the testimony today. This is an even better bill than I even thought it was, and I think I'm a co-author on it. If I'm not, I should be. And I just have to say, if there's an opportunity here to do this right in the next 48 hours ahead of our next hearing to add additional stipulations to help Representative Hansen around those same lines that we just did on Mount Simon to make sure that we're clarifying this language, that would be something that I would love to see. I understand that there's other aspects to this bill, and there might be other concerns, but if I could place priority on something, I would love to prioritize this, especially considering, and I don't want us to forget this, remember that the same water users here have taken on a significant increase in the cost of their fees. And so let's be very conscious of that, especially in light of what is happening in other states. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burkle, I don't have Chair Fisher.
I'll just be real quick. Thank you, Chair Heinzman. That's making the assumption that the water is already available. We do have several areas of the state where we already have water concerns and permits may already be overissued. So that would also have that impact that has to be kept in mind.
Representative Burkle, I'll give you the final word. You have about 20 seconds and then seconds. We'll renew the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quick. I renew my motion. Just quickly to wrap it up, I think this bill really provides that early access, and especially specifically related to the cover crop situation. We all want to see the use of cover crops. So let's keep working on this. I can work with Chair Hansen on the language he's concerned about. So I'll renew my motion that House File 3236, as amended, is laid over.
That's right. Okay, so Representative Burkle renews his motion, the House File 3236 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Bill's laid over. That concludes our agenda today, members. We are adjourned.